Welcome to Chapter 7, folks, and guess what? We've done the heavy lifting when it comes to stocks. We've gone through and discussed many of the characteristics of stocks and stock markets and the indices. We've discussed valuation techniques, ratio analysis, dividend discount models, price ratio models, and now we're going to have a little fun with silliness and discuss stock price behavior and market efficiency. And it gets even sillier in Chapter 8. A better name for this chapter might be, can you beat the market? Can you? Well, some people think they can, and there are some people who can. But most people wind up finding out that they really can't. And there are many reasons why. We have a wonderful quote here by Sir Isaac Newton. Yes, that guy, the force equals mass times acceleration, gravity, apple hitting on the head, calculus, yeah, him. I can calculate the movement of the stars, but not the madness of men. And folks, he learned from personal experience. He lost a ton of money in one of the financial scandals of his day. Yeah, technology changes, but people don't. Slide number 2. Random walks and efficient markets. Huh? Random walks. The random walk hypothesis states that the stock price movements on the markets are unpredictable. Well, in the short term, this is absolutely true. In the short term, there has never been a reliable method. There's lots of methods, but none of them have been reliable, given statistically significant tests, to predict the short-term behavior of the market. No one's been able to do it. One company in the 1990s was supposedly able to do it, Long-Term Capital Management, and they failed miserably and almost brought down the market. So in the short term, stock price movements are unpredictable. They are random. But in the long term, folks, no. You look at the long term over the span of modern financial history, and we usually often use the 1910s and 1920s. And why is that? There's some technological reasons for that, but we won't get into those. No, stock prices have not been unpredictable. As the world economy, the global economy, continues to grow and more people are taken out of poverty, I forget what it was, 20% of people live on a dollar a day or less in the world, and then is it 40% live on $2 a day or less? Yeah, until that changes, folks, we've got a long way to go. So no, in the long term, stock prices are not unpredictable. As the global economy grows, stocks, the companies that are represented by the stocks, should do well. You know, capitalism is not perfect. It's possibly the worst possible system for delivering goods and services to a country, to a population, to an economy. Except for all the others. how's all that sugar cane doing for you, Mr. Fidel? Oh, not so. Ooh, sorry. Yeah. So, Mr. Chavez, how's that bank nationalization? Oh, not great. Okay. So yeah. So we have to work to make capitalism better, or come up with something better. Good luck. Efficient market hypothesis. An efficient market is a market in which securities reflect all possible information quickly and accurately. If there are large numbers of knowledgeable investors who react quickly to new information, security prices will just adjust quickly and accurately. So the New York Stock Exchange, the NASDAQ, the large exchanges in Europe and the Far East, Australia, and now in the developing markets more and more, are efficient markets. There's plenty of investors, plenty of buyers, plenty of sellers, and so the efficient market theorists believe that the securities prices right now reflect all possible information, and those are the that's the way it should be right now. The prices are the way they should be. And there's, we've discussed this book before, A Random Walk Down Wall Street. He is one of the original professors who worked on this these studies, and he does a really good job of skewering both sides of the argument. He gets everybody. He likes to insult everybody, just like me. Slide number, including himself. I mean, he makes fun of himself and the problems that the efficient markets have, and we'll do that in the next several slides. Slide number three, the weak efficiency hypothesis. Past data on stock prices are of no use in predicting future prices. Well, stock prices do tend to demonstrate momentum, right? They tend to rise more often than they fall, and they tend to move far higher than is usually justified, resulting in a mania, or sometimes called a bubble, or they tend to fall far lower than is usually warranted, a crash. And there's a wonderful quote by a very famous economist, John Maynard Keynes, who was asked by these short-term investors who were shorting stocks, meaning they thought that the market was overvalued. And they said, you know, this is irrational. These people are bidding up these prices irrationally. These stocks are overvalued. And of course, they were losing a tremendous sum of money because they were betting on stocks to go down and stocks were going up. And his famous quote is, the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. And this is absolutely true. I know somebody who was absolutely right about the housing debacle in 2007 and 8, but he was a couple years too soon, and he started betting that the housing market would fall too soon and lost a lot of money. If this theory is true, excuse me, then technical analysis, which we'll cover in the next chapter, is useless. Okay? If this theory is true. Now, let's take a look at slide number four. Slide number four, the semi-strong efficiency hypothesis. Wait a minute, the weak, the semi-strong? Yeah, they were borrowing from the physics theorists who were using the strong, the semi-strong, the weak theories. Abnormally large profits cannot be consistently earned using publicly available information. What does that mean? Well, in other words, no amount of analysis that you do to determine the future price of a stock will help you beat the market. So in other words, they're saying all the stuff we did in Chapter 6, Chapter 17, Chapter 7, if you have the old book, the version 3, the edition 3, that's useless. But wait a minute. Wait. There are many, many investors who have beaten the market. Some famous, some unknown. We will look at them later. What does the market say about those investors, huh? I mean, it's got a problem here. The theory is saying that you can't beat the market, but there are people who are beating the market. So the theory has to come up with, you know, some way to address the reality. And what they say is, oh, these people are just lucky. Huh? Lucky? Well, I don't think so, folks. If you do the statistics, some of these people have been doing this for decades. No, it's not luck. What they're saying is, say you take 10,000 investors and you graph the results. Well, one of them out of the 10,000 is going to do really, really well, and one of them is going to do horribly, or, you know, the bell curve we talked about. Well, that may be true in the short term, but not in the long term. The probability of being lucky for 15, 20 years in a row is just, it's not there. It might happen every 217,000 years, but there's many, many people who do beat the market. And what I like to think of is an analogy that we talked about way back when we were discussing, you know, whether you're a speculator or whether you're an investor. It reminds me of the quote that is attributed to many different golfers. If you type in the quote into any search engine, you will see that lots of different golfers are attributed to this quote, he did really, really well and beat everybody else and made a ton of money and was very famous. And one reporter was asking him, was interviewing him, and said, you know, you are really lucky out there today. And the golfer said, yep, you're absolutely right. And the funny thing is, the more I practice, the luckier I get. Exactly. Can you hit that little white ball into a little hole 420 yards down the fairway? Can you hit that 97-mile-hour fastball, and then the pitcher throws you a changeup? Yeah, if you can. But there's not a whole lot of people who can do it. And we'll take a look at some of the very famous ones later on in this presentation. Slide number 5. The strong efficiency hypothesis. No amount of information, public or private, allows investors to earn abnormally large profits consistently. Huh? No. One insider information trade can make you rich overnight. If you don't get caught, that is. This is obviously false. If you had what the government calls material non-public information, we call it insider information, but the legal term is material non-public information. If you had material non-public information about a company, you could make a fortune overnight. But you could also go to jail. Yeah, in other words, if you knew a company's this is a drug development company, and you knew tomorrow or 2 days from now the FDA was going to disapprove, was going to say no, this drug has to be scrapped, it's too dangerous, you could literally make a fortune in one day. And how you do that, they're called options, but we'll deal with those later on. If you did that, the SEC hopefully would be all over you. They would see that this person's never bought and sold options, and all of a sudden they take out a huge number of these options, and it goes up 1,000% in one day. No. That's why the SEC is in existence, because you're stealing. Now, there are some people who say, no, we should allow insider trading. It shouldn't be illegal. It happens anyway, so we should... I don't know. I'm not that... well informed about the whole system to know whether or not that's a valid argument, but it's literally theft, right? You're taking advantage of information that the general public doesn't have. That was the whole idea behind the fair disclosure regulation we discussed in Chapter 17. It's a long debate. Slide number 6. The random walk and efficient market theorists are often also major proponents of index funds. They point to the fact that many professional money managers simply do not beat the market, especially during bull markets. They tend to do better during bear markets, but during bull markets, the indices usually beat the majority of money managers, especially mutual fund managers. From 1963 to 1998, the S&P 500 index outperformed general equity mutual funds, you know, the average, 22 out of 36 times. These people reason that you are better off accepting close to the market's return with low-cost index funds, since their theory tells them that no one can consistently beat the market. Now, remember, you're not going to get the market's return. Why? Because the index fund has some fees associated with it, very low, usually, and should be. Does this make sense? You see where they're coming from? In fact, as we said, Professor Malkiel, who wrote The Random Walk Down Wall Street, was also on the board of Vanguard and helped Vanguard start the index. They weren't the only ones that did it, folks, but they were certainly the most popular. Slide number 7. Why can't many pros beat the averages? Well, it's difficult. As we saw in Chapter 4 with mutual funds, many mutual funds have high annual operating expenses and high turnover rates. So you got the annual operating expenses, and if they're high, and then high turnover rates creates more transaction costs, and many mutual fund managers have very short time horizons. Why? Because they know that if they don't perform in 18, 20 months, they're going to be gone. So they have consequently a very short lifespan. But the premises and the casual observations of the efficient market theorists show them to be patently absurd, because there are many money managers who have beaten the market over long periods of time. I showed you many mutual funds that over 50 years have done very, very well. Yeah, and that's what you're going to search in Chapter 7. The more I practice. It reminds me of the interesting story. You might think it's interesting. If you don't, my apologies. But, you know, we humans have only been flying a little over 100 years. Like, we had balloons before that, but flying machines, aeroplanes. And the technology developed fairly quickly. The engineers figured out what was going on very quickly and then improved upon the technology to the point where it's the safest form of travel. It's even safer than walking across the country. But for many decades, the aerospace engineers looked at a bumblebee, not a honeybee, but a bumblebee, and said, that thing can't fly. Our theories tell us that that thing can't fly. I'm glad they never told the bumblebees. So obviously there's something wrong with the theory, right? If it wasn't until the 1990s that they finally figured out what the bumblebees were doing to overcome the constraints that we believed that they would keep them from flying. So it's the same thing true with these people. Don't tell these people they can't beat the market. They're doing it. Plus, folks, let's ask this question. If markets are efficient and rational, if they are, which I don't believe they are, because we're humans, we're not rational, and we're sometimes efficient, but not always efficient. If markets are rational and efficient, how do you explain manias, bubbles? Occasionally, investors get caught up in what are called manias, also called bubbles, and it happens. That's what the history of capitalism is. It's a history of manias and bubbles and then subsequent crashes. The internet bubble of the 1990s was the latest stock mania. Before that, there was the Nifty 50 of the early 1970s. These were companies that if you bought them, nothing's going to go wrong. You're going to make a ton of money, and most of them are all gone. You might have heard of Calcomp or Tektronix. Yeah, those were the technology companies that weren't the only ones. Avon, which has never recovered to its high of 1972. Polaroid. Look, they went bankrupt in 1998, right? Someone bought the name. I don't know, folks. I would not want to buy a company whose name rhymes with hemorrhoid. I just wouldn't want to do it. And before that, there was the mania of the 1920s that resulted in the crash of 1929. What were the internet stocks, the social media stocks of the 1920s? Radio. Radio Corporation of America. You might know it as RCA. Reached $290 or so, I think, in 1929, and then 4 years later it was $2. In the 1840s, there were 400 railroad firms. Now there's less than a handful of large railroad firms. But the granddaddy of all manias, folks, was the Dutch tulip bulb craze of the early 1600s. Yes, you heard that right, tulip bulbs. And they didn't start in the Netherlands, folks. Tulips originally from Turkey, I think. And that was the craze. Tulip bulbs were sold and purchased like any other security. And the prices were bid up to the point where at the height of the mania, one tulip bulb sold for what today would be worth $1.5 million. Now, when you put a tulip bulb in the ground, what does it do? It does what all life does. It struggles to reproduce. And you get a whole lot more little tulip bulbs. Exactly. That, of course, wasn't going to last and did eventually crash and burn. And there's two wonderful books that you want to read the first one more importantly than the second one, but the second one is extraordinary. But the first one, Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds, I used that word twice, is written in the 1840s, and it still shocks you. It still shocks you. It doesn't tell you why. I mean, we really don't know why. It probably has something to do with our genes and what kept us alive 500,000, 2 million years ago that's still in our genes now. But we are not a rational, as much as we'd like to think we are, we're not a rational species. If we see a whole bunch of people running one way, what do? We run with them. Why is that? Well, they believe, we don't know, but what they believe is because the people who didn't run, who said, ooh, look at all those people running that way, they're the ones that got eaten by the tiger. Right? So they didn't get to pass on their genes, did they? No. So this will explain to you how, not why, how it was easy, relatively, for a madman, an evil genius, to turn an entire country into a Nazi Germany. And yes, Jews were inferior. Jews were responsible for all the ills of the world, and we have to kill them. It was able for Soviet Union to become the dictatorship of the proletariat, which would bring about, in 5 years, the socialist paradise on earth. How's it working? No, not too good. We were able to turn a country, relatively peaceful loving country like the United States, into a war machine against a country that supposedly had weapons of mass destruction. I still look around and people just act like, did we really go to war with Iraq and we invaded them? But no, that couldn't have happened. Yeah, it's amazing. And one of my students said it wonderfully. He said it really well. He said, it's easier to fool 100 million people than it is to fool one. Uh-huh. The Botany of Desire is another book that I submit to you, but it's really only has some finance, and it has some good finance, but it really is a discussion about plants and how we think we rule the plants, but in reality, they rule us. They get us to plant them, they get us to water them and keep their bugs away and keep the weeds away. Who's the ruler, we or the corn? Each time in these manias, the phrase was, it's a new era. It's different this time. The old ways of valuing stock are gone. And of course, each time they were wrong. So much for rational, efficient markets. Markets are not always rational. Markets can stay irrational far longer than you can stay solvent. Slide number 9. Why do manias occur over and over again? Why haven't investors learned their lesson? By the way, the 2008-2009 crash was not because of the stock market, folks. It wasn't. It was because of the bond market, specifically the bonds that were tied to mortgages, mortgage-backed securities. We'll deal with them when we get to bonds. Because all of us believed, and this wasn't the only country that was doing it, Spain, the UK, Ireland, Portugal to some extent, all of us believed that housing would never go down. It would just continue to rise. We like to think we're far more sophisticated than those buffoons who spent outrageous amount of money for tulips. We spent outrageous amount of money for two-bedroom condos that were $80,000 in 1998, and now they're $380,000. But don't worry, yikes. Why haven't we learned our lesson? Well, here's one idea. Market manias will happen over and over again because the public is infinitely stupid. I love that quote from Leonard Kaplan, president of commodities brokerage firm Prospector Asset Management in Evanston, Illinois. What does Mr. Graham, Benjamin Graham, that's Warren Buffett's teacher, he wrote The Intelligent Investor, what does he say about manias? Slide number 10. The speculative public is incorrigible. Notice he qualifies it with the speculative. He doesn't say the whole public, but the speculative public is incorrigible. It will buy anything at any price if there seems to be some action in progress. It will fall for any company identified with franchising, computers, electronics, science, technology, or what have you, when the particular fashion is raging. The abuses are so largely the result of the public's own heedlessness and greed. So in other words, he's saying, don't blame Wall Street. I mean, that's like blaming the drug pusher for your heroin addiction. And he wrote this in the final edition that he wrote before he passed away in 75. So he's talking about 1972, that's when he wrote this. And that's when we talked about CalComp and and the other electronics companies. And the companies like Avon. If you replace franchising, computers, etc., with internet and biotechnology, etc., good old Ben could have been writing in 2000 instead of 1972. Today, what are the buzzwords? Social networking and anything to do with China. Yeah, just throw China in the name of the company. Slide number 11. How do most manias end? Yeah, you guessed it. They invariably end with a crash. Great quote. The bigger the party, the bigger the hangover. Look, they're not fun. They're not fun, but the odds are you will live through at least one, probably two, maybe three, because they seem to be happening closer and closer during your investing career. And this is a gentleman who in 1999 was considered absolutely off his rocker, old-fashioned, fuddy-duddy, all washed up. With this many strong years, I have the concern that there are a vast majority of companies that are significantly overvalued on a long-term basis. This was John Lovelace, who just passed away just a few months ago. August 1999, mutual fund investor with, at the time, 50 years of experience. He retired in about a year after this, 2001 or so, year and a half after this. Oh, by the way, as we said, the 2008-2009 market crash was not caused by a stock market bubble. It was the real estate bubble and the mortgage-backed bonds that were tied to the real estate mortgages. So, yeah, don't blame the stock, even though the stock market, everybody went down in 2008. Slide number 12. Here are the 11 worst days of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And those of you in the face-to-face class, if you came to the face-to-face class, we show a little film called Black Monday and Beyond about the crash of 1987, which was the largest one-day drop, October 19th, 1987. But if you look at October 2, 1929, it happened over 2 days. You know, basically the same amount, but it took 2 days to do it. And then November 1929. And what do you notice? Notice 2008. I'm sorry, 2008 made it into the top 10, but it relatively was, you know, wasn't that big. Not even 8%. I mean, a little less than 8%. What do you notice about these days? Look at the number of occurrences of days in the month of October. How many? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6! 6 out of 11! And one of them is in November, early November, which is, you know, pretty close to October. And notice that they're later October. Now, there have been many different theories, many different speculations about why the majority of crashes happen in October. And none of them are very convincing, folks. The one that I think is the most convincing, and there is no way to prove this, is that we have proven once again that we are not rational beings. As much as we'd like to think that we're divorced from the natural world, we're still animals. We're still Homo sapien homos who had to fight and claw and scratch our way through survival just like every other species. We don't remember this because we turn on the light, we turn on the heat, We flip a switch, push a button, and we think we have mastery over nature. But no, nature bats last. Have you heard that saying? And so what happens at the end of October, beginning of November? Right. We call it the fall for a reason. All the plants die. And many of the animals go into hibernation. And the winter comes, and it's cold, and you look around, or at least 500, 1,000, 5,000 years ago, you looked around, and you realized that, hey, you know, a lot of us aren't going to be around to see the next spring and summer. And there's a very good reason, folks, symbolically, why Halloween, All Hallows Eve, is at the end of October, the beginning of November. Because that's when we commemorated the dead, because we knew some of us are going to be following them. People don't like Halloween anymore. They consider it of the devil. No, it was nothing to do with the devil. It had to do with death. It's the time of death. And so there's no way to prove this, but that's what I believe, and I'm not the only one who believes this. It makes perfect sense, because we are not rational. We are animals. We still have animal behaviors. We run with the crowd, trying not to be eaten by the tiger. And for some reason, the fact that we're attuned to the natural rhythms of the seasons, fall comes around, and instead of panicking for our lives, we panic for our finances. There's no way of proving that, but that's my story, and I'm sticking with it. Slide number 13. Index funds, market indices, manias, and crashes. Does this slide look familiar? Yes, we showed it back in Chapter 4. And now, hopefully, after we've gotten through stocks and you understand what PE is and what the MSCI EFA and the S&P 500 are, now this slide should be much more informative. It should be much more useful to you. Recall that index funds and exchange-traded funds rely on market indices. And the theory that is promoted by the people who believe you can't beat the market, instead of trying to beat the market, just buy the market, just buy the index fund or the exchange-traded fund, and be happy with the market's return. The problem with that is sometimes an index can become skewed. You like that word, skewed, bent out of shape? Especially when a sector or a region of the world or a region of the economy becomes hot, so to speak. And as we said way back in Chapter 4, the EFA, the Europe, Australia, and the Far East, the market index, the industry that was used for many decades to describe what's going on outside the United States, it's now being replaced by the MSCI All Country World ex-USA Index. How's that for a mouthful? At the end of the 1980s, was fully 60% Japan. So, you know, the other 40% was Europe, which is, by the way, a whole lot bigger than Japan as a, Europe as a whole, and Australia and other Far East countries. The Japanese stock market index had a PE of 51.9, and now you understand that that's a pretty darn high PE. If things don't go as well as everybody believes they're going to go, the parachutes had better be very, very large, because you're going to fall really far. Everybody else made up 40% with a PE of only 13. So you bought the EFA index thinking that you were getting a broad diversification of all the companies based outside the United States. And what you were doing is you were concentrating in Japan. Japan then went on to lose, went from 38,000 down to 8,000. What is that? 80%?
Yeah.
The same thing happened in the S&P 500. In March of 2000, the S&P had produced 15% returns for 15 years. For 10 years, it was close to 18%. And so you thought you're getting this wonderful index, broadly diversified, 500 largest companies based in the United States, and what you were actually doing was buying fully one-third of the S&P 500 were companies in the information technology. This includes the internet companies and the telecoms and all the other startups that were around at the time. eBay with its PE of 10,000. And the PE was almost 60, 59.2. Everybody else, folks, everybody else, the cars, the energy, the healthcare, the paper products, the materials, the groceries, the consumer staples companies, everybody else made up two-thirds with a PE of 19. Now, still pretty high, but not almost 60. And what happened over the next 2.5 years, the S&P 500 went on to lose almost 50% of its value. The NASDAQ, which measures the information portion, yeah, the tech-heavy NASDAQ went on to lose 80% of its value. So you understand, when people tell you that index funds, oh yeah, just buy the index. You know, nothing is perfect. I'm not trying to knock and say you shouldn't buy an index fund. What I'm trying to get you to do is understand that everything has advantages, everything has its disadvantages. And this is one of the problems with index funds. Slide number 14. And we're going to add to this anomalies, silly theories, and oddities. And the fact that these things actually get press time and are talked about on the news shows, the financial news shows, and read about on the internet, on magazines, just shows you how silly we really are, how irrational. The Monday effect. It's the best day to buy. Or is it the best day to sell? I don't know. Read about it. The January effect. As goes January, so goes the year. Well, sometimes that's true. Sometimes it's not true. The Santa Claus rally that's called the turn of the year effect. What is that supposed to mean? Well, around Christmas, I guess people get in a jovial mood and they typically, the market goes up. Doesn't always happen. If the market doesn't go up, they say, oh, people are selling for tax purposes. They're selling to lock in some losses or some gains. Sell in May and go away. You'll hear people say this. Well, you know, they're absolutely right. It turns out that the market does better from, say, November to March, April, than it does from May to October. And much of that is because September and October are the worst months. But over the long term, folks, it may be 0.5% or 1% better. It's statistically significant over the long term, but is it going to change your returns over the long term? Probably not. Why? Because emotions, if you're going to follow these precepts, you're probably going to let your emotions catch over. Because the last couple of years, it was August that was the worst month, and September and October actually did okay. So, yeah. If you sold in May and went away last year in 2011, you actually did pretty well, but other years you missed out. So I am not advising that you even try to do these things, but it's up to you. The Super Bowl theory. Oh, this drives me up a wall. Every year. Well, the Super Bowl is such a big cultural icon in the United States, so I guess we can be forgiven for attaching it to everything. But supposedly the National League, or a team that started out in the National League and now is in the American League, I don't know, wins, that means the stock market's going to go up. The American League, if it wins, the stock market goes down. It's actually fairly, correspondent. It's actually been true for many, not all the time, but many. And you think, well, what's the connection? Have you ever heard of coincidence? About, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago, somebody figured out that if you play the album from Pink Floyd called Dark Side of the Moon, one of the biggest selling albums of all time, you started playing that at the same time you started watching The Wizard of Oz. The scenes change at the exact same time as the music. And people, you know, attributed some kind of, you know, maybe Pink Floyd, because they wrote the album's 1972 and the movies was 39 or something like that. So they thought, no. You go back and ask the people, the producer, Alan Parsons, you talk to the band members, no, they weren't thinking of that. You think about the thousands and thousands of movies and thousands of rock albums and other albums. Yeah, it would make sense that two of them somehow would line up just because of coincidence. Hemlines of skirts. You gotta love this one. Mini skirts. When hemlines go up, so does the stock market. Well, 1920s, 1960s, hemlines went up. In 1930s and 1970s, long skirts became more popular and the stock market went down. Yeah. And there are many other silly indicators, such as the lipstick indicator, the Boston snow indicator, often called the BS indicator, the hot waitress indicator, and the aspirin count theory. And if you are so inclined, you would like to watch how silly humans can be, do look these up. And lastly, let's take a look at politics and the stock market, right? Poly means many, and ticks are blood-sucking insects. No, politics. Which party, the Republicans or the Democrats, which one is better for the stock market? Well, you know, the Republicans have done a pretty good job of convincing everybody that they're better for the stock market, but it doesn't pan out. When there have been Republican administrations, the market's actually done worse over the long term. And Democratic administrations, it's done better. Well, is it because the Democrats are better at the economy than the Republicans? No. Much of it has to do with just bad timing. The crash of 1929, Hoover. The crash of 72, Nixon. The crash of 87, Reagan. The crash of 2002, 2009, the younger. So a lot of it was just, you know, bad luck. And as, you know, with all the demagoguery and all the posturing and the like, both parties are fairly similar when it comes to their outlook on capitalism and the like. Now, the Democrats are definitely more pro-regulation, and there is a special place in hell for people who over-regulate, and many of them are Democrats. But look what happened during the Bush. Later Bush years, and look, it started a long time ago. It started during Reagan's time, and Elder Bush and Clinton were all very much pro deregulation, and look what we got from that. So there's another place in hell for people who don't regulate enough. We get the credit default swaps and all the picadillos and the insurance and in Wall Street, and so many of those people are Republicans. So there's a lot of blame to go around, folks. Yeah. Slide number 415. All stars of investing. Okay, so I added this. This is not from your book. Peter Lynch. You really want to read his book, One Up on Wall Street, folks. It's such a fun, of course, that's me. It's such a fun book to read because you think, this guy's going to be some bleeding genius. And he really is, but he's down to earth. He says, buy what you know. Look, don't go looking at the new nanotechnology, biotechnology, social network. And maybe you do understand social network better than I do. I can't. I'm waiting for that whole internet fad to just blow over. I know it's going to happen. One of these days, the whole thing's going to crash, and everybody's going to go back to writing letters to one another. buy what you know. You wear Nike shoes. Go look at Nike. Maybe it's a good investment. Maybe it's not. You go to Pizza Crap and Taco Smell and Kentucky Fried Rat. Well, go look at Yum Brands. Maybe it's a good investment. Look at that one. And so make sure you understand the company you invest in. Warren Buffett, we've talked about him quite a bit. Don't buy a stock, buy a company. He puts emphasis on the value of the entire company. In other words, if you could buy all of Federal Express, if you could own Federal Express, which, you know, you need several billion dollars to do, tens of billions of dollars to do so, but if you could and you would buy it, great, go ahead and buy 10 shares. You understand? Now, of course, he's big enough, he buys the whole company. Benjamin Graham was Warren Buffett's teacher. He's often called the father of value investing. You're going to read The Intelligent Investor, right? Yes, you are. Nod your heads yes. I want every come on, you too. Nod yes. You're going to read this eventually. Read one up on Wall Street first. And then John Templeton, one of the first mutual fund managers, Sir John Templeton, one of the first mutual fund managers to invest globally. Slide number 16. And then Mr. Miller, Bill Miller. Poor Bill Miller. Do you feel sorry for him? Don't feel too sorry for him. He's retiring very rich. He is still, by the end of this year, he will have retired, the fund manager of the Legg Mason Value Trust. And for 15 calendar years in a row, he beat the S&P 500. An unprecedented record. It reminds me, again, I'm not a big sports fan, but I often use analogies in sports. And forgive me if you hate sports. You know, Mr. Padre, very famous here. What's his name? Oh, he's a Salvador. Tony Gwynn. Right, Tony Gwynn. He's got a street named after him. And we wish him much success. He has cancer, right? He's battling cancer right now. We wish him much success. Well, he won the batting championship for the major leagues, folks. 7 times? I don't know. Maybe it was more. Maybe it was less. I don't remember. Unbelievable. Do you realize what the competition is? Do you understand how competitive? Same thing here. Nobody's going to beat, maybe somebody down, you know, several years from now, but 15 years in a row. And of course, as that was happening, he became, as far as I'm concerned, unfortunately, because I could not work this way. He became the financial media's megastar. Can you imagine trying to work with people listening to every word you say, shining their 10,000 watt spotlight on your back as you're trying to work? I would drive me insane. One of the weird things about putting these presentations on iTunes, I just did it so that people who had Apple iPads and iPhones and iPod Touches can watch the presentations because they don't support Flash. And so one of the folks at Southwestern who's very media savvy said, put them on iTunes. Oh, okay. Well, I'm getting all kinds of reviews, and some people like the presentations, and some people hate them. This guy is hard to take. Boy, is he annoying. Hey, it's free if you don't listen to it, all right? Well, that's one of the things that you have to deal with if you become a very famous mutual fund manager or money manager. You're going to get all kinds of people saying horrible things, wonderful things, neutral things about you. What happened, folks, is he did not beat the S&P 500 in 2006 and then lagged badly in 2007 and 2008. Boy, did he stink up the joint. And this is, you know, people would ask me, well, if you know, why don't you invest with Mr. Miller? Why don't you invest with Bill Miller? And I would say, you know, I wish him well, but I really don't like his investing style. He made large bets, as it's often called. His mutual fund had typically 45, 50, 40 stocks. Why do we buy a mutual fund? Right, for diversification. Most mutual funds have 150 or 200 stocks. If your bets do well, yeah, you're going to have a great returns. If they don't do well, exactly. So he really did not do well in 2006 to 2008. He seemed to redeem himself in 2009 when he was up over 40%, which beat the 26% of the S&P 500 that year. But then again, he trailed badly in 2010 and 11. So instead of Legg Mason canning him, which I'm surprised they let him stay there as long as they did. I'm glad they did, just because they wanted to treat him, treat him well, but usually it's a brutal business. People just, if you don't do well after a few years, after a couple of years, after sometimes 18 months, you're out of there. So they're allowing him to retire. And he is in retirement age. He doesn't have to keep working. So don't feel too bad for Mr. Miller, okay? Slide number 17. What do all these people have in common? Well, folks, they have courage to not follow the crowd. Everybody's running that way. What do? They go, maybe it's a good idea to run that way. Maybe it's not, because the conventional wisdom is usually not very wise. And they have what I like to call an eye for unrecognized value. Some people call it a sixth sense. In other words, they see value that no one else sees, or they see a bubble forming. They see people going gaga over something that's not worth what they believe it's worth. And it's not easy. Garry Kasparov was once asked why he and Anatoly Karpov were the two best chess players in the world. Now, who were these people? In the late 80s, early 90s, they were the two best chess players in the world. One would win the world title, and the next year the other one would beat the other one, and they were fighting back and forth. And it really took its toll on the both of them. They would say, this is grueling. You think chess is not grueling? Oh, yes, it is. Read about Mr. Bobby Fischer, one of the world's greatest chess players. The guy went nuts. His answer was astonishingly simple and direct. We attack better than anybody else, and we defend better than anybody else. He said it very simply. In other words, we're the best at what we do. Can you beat somebody in that little game of medieval game of war? Can you hit that ball at 95 miles an hour? Can you, hit that little golf ball down 320 yards down the fairway, par 4? These people, these all-stars of investing, they bought the best companies and they avoided the worst companies. So you sports fans, offense is important, but in many ways, defense is even more important, isn't it? So slide number 18. Speaking of avoidance, as a mutual fund investor, which mostly I am not looking to find the next Peter Lynch or the next Bill Miller or the next Warren Buffett. Oh, no, folks. I am looking to avoid the next Charles Stedman. And have you ever heard of Charles Stedman? No, you haven't. There's a reason why you haven't heard of Charles Stedman. He ran his own mutual fund, the Stedman American Industry Fund. He named it after himself. Not a good sign. From December 1959 until his death in late 1997. His cumulative total return during one of the largest, or the largest, increase of the global economy was minus 42.9%. He lost 40-some percent of his investors' money over 40 years, while the stock market went up, 2,000 whatever percent, or 20 times or whatever. He would have done much better simply placing his investors' funds into a savings account at a bank. He would have done better putting it in a mattress. I don't know, maybe he came from the life insurance industry where this is typical. So that's what I'm after, you understand? I'm not so interested in good offense. I mean, I like good offense, but I want good defense. Slide number 19. Mr. Buffett, what does he say about investing? Be fearful when others are greedy. Be greedy when others are fearful. And did he take his own advice? Oh, yeah. Throughout the internet.com bubble, he stayed on the sidelines. He said, I don't understand these companies. I'm not investing in them. Throughout the 2000s, he did a little bit, but mostly sat on the sidelines. When the 2008 organic matter hit the ventilating device, he swooped in and bought a ton of GE and a ton of Goldman Sachs. And the Goldman Sachs turned out to be a brilliant move. The GE has worked out for him, but not like the Goldman Sachs. Recently, he bought a big share of Bank of America. I don't know about that one. His mentor, Benjamin Graham, said it this way. Buy when most people, including experts, are overly optimistic and sell when they are actively I said it wrong. I'm sorry. Let's try it again. My apologies. Buy when most people, including the experts, are overly pessimistic and sell when they are actively optimistic. You understand? Everybody's running one way. What do? You run the other way. Right? Not easy. It's easier said than done, folks. Slide 20. John Templeton. Sir John Templeton. Pretty good for a guy from Tennessee, where he originally was from. Bear markets are born of pessimism, grow on skepticism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. The time of maximum pessimism is the best time to buy. Invest when there's blood in the streets, is the old saying, but that's from the 1700s. On a similar note, he also said, buy when others are despondently selling and sell when others are avidly buying requires the greatest fortitude and pays the greatest reward. Now, did Sir John Templeton follow his own advice? It turns out he did. December 1941, you students of history, what will that tell you, right? What happened in December? Right, the United States was finally dragged into World War II when the Japanese Imperial Navy attacked Pearl Harbor. And, you know, things were still going pretty bad for Uncle Joe in Soviet Union. Herr Hitler was running rampant. He had already taken over all of Europe, gave up on Britain. But, yeah, it didn't look good for the free world. One third of the Pacific Fleet was sunk on a single day. What does Sir John Templeton do? He calls up his broker and says, I want you to buy every company on the New York Stock Exchange that is in bankruptcy. What? Would you have that kind of courage? 4 years later, Mr. Templeton is a very wealthy man because some of those companies didn't come back, but the ones that did, oh boy, yeah. Would you have that kind of courage? Now, what we're going to do is take a couple of slides and address what are called famous myths and stupid sayings, because this is what you're going to hear from people. It can't go any lower. Oh, yes, it can. It can go to zero. Once it goes to zero, it can't go any lower. Until it hits zero. Remember Liquidation Motors selling at 4 cents or 3 cents? It's going to go to zero. Once it hits zero, it can't go any lower. It can't go any higher. Huh? Is there a speed limit? A limit? Okay, that's it. $100 a share, that's it. Much has been made about Apple just when it finally hit $500 billion. And some other companies have been there, and they've subsequently fallen. Oh, yes, it can. If the earnings are continuing to grow, there is no limit to how high the price can go. This is what they kept saying about Procter & Gamble and Altria, Philip Morris. It can't go any higher. Oh, yeah? Coca-Cola. It's only $3 a share. What can I lose? It doesn't matter how low the price is. The price can go to zero, and you can lose all your money. So if someone says it's only 25 cents a share, it's only a dollar a share, what can I lose? You say a dollar. You can lose all. Price is irrelevant. Valuation, market capitalization is the key. It has to come back. Have any of you heard of Penn Central? No. You've heard of Penn Station, Penn Center, underneath Madison Square Garden in New York? Yeah, it used to be part of Pennsylvania Railroad, Penn Central. The most spectacular bankruptcy up to its time in 1969. Braniff Airlines, TWA, Kodak. Slide number 22. It's always darkest before the dawn. Oh, yeah? Well, sometimes it's always darkest before it's pitch black. When it rebounds to $10, I will sell. Okay, I know what's going on here, right? This is human nature. He bought it at $10. It's now selling for $4 or $3 or who knows. He wants to be able to get out at the $10 price he paid for it. That way he can say, I didn't make a mistake. I broke even. Because we're humans. We don't like to admit that we were wrong. If you would not buy it at the price it is right now, if it's to sit at $3 and you wouldn't buy it, it's time to sell. It's time to move on. And here's what happens to us. We're wired. We're humans. We're wired to forget unpleasant experiences. Sell the stock, you quickly forget about it. You quickly forget that you lost $700 or whatever, however much you lost. You'll forget about that. If you hang on to it, stubbornly waiting for it to come back to what you bought it at, every time you look at the screen or look at your statement or whatever, you're going to be reminded of how stupid you were. You see? Sell. If it goes down 10%, sell. All right, or 20%, sometimes it'll be 20%. You see what they're trying to do here is they're trying to get you to avoid large losses. They're saying it could go down even further, right? So if it starts to go down, set a stop. Remember the transaction, a stop loss, and have it sell automatically. The problem with this, folks, is that stock prices fluctuate greatly. Even blue chip stocks, even the Procter & Gambles of the world and the IBMs and the McDonald's of the world, even those companies fluctuate greatly. So if you sold each stock that lost 10%, you would almost always sell your winners along with your losers. And we're going to see in Chapter 7, holding on to your winners is the way most people become very wealthy in stocks. It is taking too long. Well, guess what? It does take a long. It doesn't happen overnight. Some people become rich in the stock market overnight, but it's the very, very few take their company public. Patience is an investor's most important trait. Besides, folks, it gives you a chance to buy more, right? If it skyrockets, oh well, it's time to sell or it's time to hang on. Slide 23. Look at all the money I've lost. I didn't buy it. Huh? Coulda, woulda, shoulda. You did not lose a cent by not buying a stock that did well. Don't fret over it. I missed that one. I'll catch the next one. The next one rarely arrives. Why wait for the next Microsoft? Is the next Microsoft not in the software industry, folks? It's going to be some other thing, you know. So if you're interested in a good software company investment, well, a good investment, not very good software. I'm not a big fan of Microsoft software, but buy Microsoft. Because the next industry, there's going to be another Microsoft. It's not going to be Microsoft. It's going to be some other company and whatever new technology comes along. Now, there's the exceptions to this. Remember Home Depot. They pioneered the big box, put the little guy hardware, local hardware store out of business. And yet they missed an opportunity to totally dominate. Lowe's came along, right? Yeah. So sometimes the next one does show up. The stock has gone up. I must be a genius. No. Never mistake a bull market for brains, is an old Wall Street saying. You know, people, sometimes you'll hear people say, I got in at 1982. What a bad deal that was. Why? Because the market went straight up for several years. I thought I was invincible. Mm-hmm. The market's gone down. I must be an idiot. No, it's just the same thing in reverse. You it might just have nothing to do with you, like 2008 and 2009. Nothing to do with you. It has something to do with forces way beyond all of our control. Slide 24. It's different this time. Well, you know, this is actually true. Every day is a new day. It is different every time. But I heard once someone say there's an echo. It's not that history repeats itself, but there's an echo, you know, echoes of the past. It is different every time, but that doesn't mean you should pay an astronomical price for a company that probably will never make a dollar's worth of profit, the internet stocks of the late 1990s. Now, some of them are making money, but it's a new era. Okay, ditto, when you hear this one, it's time to sell. It's a permanent a permanent trend? That's an oxymoron. Trends are trends because they're not permanent. Military intelligence, jumbo shrimp, straight curve, right? Ain't no such thing, folks. Markets move in cycles. Stocks are too risky. You'll hear people say that, especially when they find out that you're investing. They'll go, oh, no, stocks are too risky. And what you have to do is you have to acknowledge that there is an element of risk and say, you know, I understand your concern, but even with all the shenanigans, all the stupidity, all the, the crooks, they still are the best long-term financial investment. I should throw the term in financial investment because there are some people who do very, very well in real estate. We'll get to that long. I should sneak the little word financial investment. Over time. And they really have beaten on an absolute dollar term real estate, but it's not comparing apples to apples. You invest in real estate differently, and we'll discuss that later on. Slide 25. That's it. We're done chapter 7. When we come back, we're going to discuss behavioral finance and the psychology of investing. Yeah, that's a big thing now, behavioral finance. And also, we'll take a look at what is called technical analysis. And after that, we're done with stocks. See you next chapter.